Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
I'm doing fine. Good. Ready to go.
Yes.
Give you a chance to help me solve all the problems of the world.
You will do it.
But you know why we are effective? Because we recognize our limitation. And that's why we don't get overly frustrated. But then we also know that ideas are important. And sometimes it takes a while. And if you plant some seeds, some benefits may come of it. And every once in a while, I'm delighted when I find more people out there someplace that I never heard about and heard from them. And here, they're very busy, you know, in their own way, doing exactly what we do, trying to spread a message and get people to understand it. And a lot of them watch our program. So we have a mission, and we're always challenged, at least I feel challenged, to find out exactly what's going on and try to make an analysis. But in some ways, it's easy when you take a non-interventionist policy in economics and foreign policy and personal liberties. It's not hard to figure out what our position ought to be. Just get out of the way. Let people take care of themselves. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, but we're going to go back to a foreign policy event that we've done a little bit more, because it's not that the coronavirus and the lockdowns aren't important. They are continue to be important, but we don't want people to forget that there's a lot of hot spots around the world, and we'll never be able to avoid that. But the one we're going to talk about, we have been involved even more than we are right now, but I'm sure we're still involved, even though we're not in the news, and that has to do with Libya.
Yeah.
And of course, when Hillary was in office, she had something to say about it, and that was, I think it was 2011 that happened. But, you know, I was looking at a national interest article written several years after that, and they were describing in brief detail what Libya was like. Oh, well, they had a bad dictator, and we had to get rid of him, and we recognized he was a dictator and not a nice guy, but it was none of our business, and you couldn't make things worse, which really has turned out that way. And it starts off with, prior to the February 17, 2011 day of rage, Libya's national budget surplus was 8.7% of GDP in 2010, with oil production at 1.8 million barrels per day, on track to reach its goal of 3 million barrels per day. So it sounded like a country that imperfect but had oil and they were surviving, and something like maybe Venezuela. But then when things were broken down, I guess we got a little bit involved in Venezuela as well, but Hillary got involved in this. And since that time, things have not gone well, because there's a conflict there. Who's running Libya? Who has the oil? Is it all about oil? Is it all about the Muslim Brotherhood? Is it about the Egyptians who want to invade, you know, and or is it the Turks that want to take it over? There's a lot of things going on. But one thing that we would agree on, I think, is there's not a lot of stability there. And I was trying to figure this out, and how much influence we have at this very moment and how much influence the Russians have. I sort of get the impression that both of the United States and Russia were sort of standing by, watching, paying close attention, but we haven't been involved in the threats. The threats are coming between the Turks and the Egyptians, and that's what could get out of hand. Then I think the standing by of Russia and America won't happen much longer. We're probably much involved now. It's probably secret or something. They might even have CIA agents over there, for all we know. But anyway, Hillary left us a mess, and I didn't like her attitude when she thought she did something really neat. It sounded like a failed politician or something.
Yeah, she was cackling over the fact that Gaddafi was brutally murdered. You know, I'm wondering about, you know, the humanitarian interventions. In some ways, they seem even crueler than just an out-and-out theft. You know, like Trump said, hey, I'm going to take your oil. It almost sounds, to me, it seems worse, because when you have the humanitarian, quote-unquote, they think they're doing it for your own good. They truly think they're helping you. And nobody wants to talk about Libya, because Libya is a shining example of the failure of humanitarian interventionism, the idea that outsiders know better than the people who live there what's good for them. And you have, you know, warring parties, warlords, you have open slave trade, And this was once the highest standard of living in Africa, or among the highest standards of living, certainly in northern Africa. And, you know, and Gaddafi made a lot of money from oil. He spent a lot of it on the people. They had 80% illiteracy when he took over, and they had 25% college graduation later. And there's a lot of stats like this, and it doesn't mean we endorse the idea that the big strong man is taking care of everyone, but he certainly wasn't, was improving the standard of living. But we're talking about it now because earlier this week, the Egyptian parliament authorized Egyptian troops to go into Libya. Let's put up this map because it's a good idea to have a sense of these places. So you have Egypt. Right next door is Libya. You see up there is Turkey. Turkey is the only foreign country with troops stationed inside Libya. So Turkey is obviously a little bit concerned, shall we say, if Egypt decides to move in. Now, Egypt backs Haftar, and Turkey, along with nominally the U.S. and the EU, back the unelected UN GNA government, Government of National Accord. So you have these two factions, main factions, that are fighting against each other. And as you point out, the UN faction is closely aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey. So you have a possibility of a real ground war breaking out among two very large countries. One of them happens to be a NATO member, it's a recipe for disaster. And it just is a reminder of what the results are of a disastrous foreign policy, and for all of Trump's mistakes in foreign policy, and we could write a book on them, at least he hasn't done anything yet as blatantly, bloodthirstily evil as Obama and Hillary did in Libya.
I think this point about NATO or United Nations is one of the dangers, and it seems like Trump more or less recognizes this because he criticizes them, but he uses them too. But that's what drags us in there. You know, we're part of NATO and we want to run NATO, and it came up with Syria, you know, and Turkey, and they say, oh, well, we can't oppose Turkey. They're part of NATO, and how could we have two NATO? Well, I think that antagonism, the whole area, because it's not going to be solved very easily, I think that's going to continue, and eventually NATO is going to disappear, or they will have to change their goals or something. But those are the kind of organizations, and I'm all for diplomacy and trying to work things out, but I don't think international government bodies that are pseudo-governments and they have pseudo-power, and they say they don't have armies, but they do have armies, and we say that we complain because we have to pay too much of the, too much of their expenses, but we run them. I mean, if you do, you own the company, you know. Yeah. And I think that's what's happened. So even now, so that we're pretty quiet over there. NATO's involved, and our money is being used, and we do know that if there's a hot war over there, if it breaks out, nobody can predict exactly how hot it gets and who gets involved. Will Russia get involved, and do we send our Navy over there, or do we send our bombers over there? And it's best, I think, geography, even though the world's getting smaller because of travel being so fast, I still think it helps me to think about the distance. How far do we have to go to get involved and pester people? And I think of the South China Sea. Yeah, I think of the whole Middle East. You know, this was the whole thing, how we were going to do wonders for Iraq and Afghanistan. But right now, of course, we're struggling, and the Congress won't let, at least won't approve of getting out of Afghanistan. So it's these international bodies, but we're very much involved in NATO, and I think it would be hard for me to predict what's going to happen next week or next month, but I don't consider it very stable. I think almost anything could happen any time. That could be a very, very serious matter.
And if you back out just a little bit more, Russia has become a major player in Libya, and they're on the opposite side of Turkey on this issue. And so Russia has been also backing. It has some mercenaries in there fighting, and it's backing them. So you have a broader conflict that's brewing. Ironically, with all the Russophobia in the U.S., every foreign policy move the U.S. takes seems to strengthen Russia's hand. Maybe they just need an enemy. But, you know, our friend Scott Ritter, who spoke at our conference before, he had a good piece in RT that we republished earlier this week, I think, on the Ron Paul Institute website. And he talked about another incident. Turkey is just running roughshod. Another incident between Turkey and France. So Turkey was running weapons to Libya. It has troops there. And the French military sought to board the Turkish ship, which was being escorted by some warships. And it's an important incident because they're both NATO members. Well, the Turks signaled with their radar that they're ready to engage their weapons if France pushes this idea of boarding that ship. And Turkey backed off. Of course, it would violate the arms embargo for the Turks to be shipping arms, which they're doing. But you had very close to a conflict between Turkey and France, and now Turkey and Greece are now at each other's throats again in the Mediterranean. So you really are looking at a conflagration, and I think that's why we wanted to bring it up in the context of everyone's kind of distracted by putting their face masks on and breathing too much CO2, not thinking straight. While that's happening, even Trump, while that's happening, this is something that really needs to be paid attention to.
Yeah, I think this is all should be expected, because when people go bankrupt, whether it's personal, corporations, or countries, they get in a panic mode. And I think this is what's happening now, is it's unsuccessful because there's no real wealth. We're really bankrupt. And we then get into these fights, and then we get to fighting over the oil. And we continue to do this, and where there's no end in sight. So I think that measuring the distance we go to get involved is a big deal. And I think that when Russia gets in there and gets involved, you know, that'll put a great burden on us. But, you know, the United States is probably still the wealthiest country in the world. But right now, the dollar's going down sharply. The budget is unbelievably out of control. And yet there's really not been, there's panicky moods, but every time there's a little bit of panic on Wall Street, you know, our government just said, we're going to print faster and faster, and we're going to pass it out. The helicopters are ready. The helicopters are running, and they try to settle things down. So then people say, well, see, this is a minor item, because everybody's running their printing presses. And that's why I think, and I have said it many times, I think we're in the midst of the biggest bubble in the history of mankind, and it's fraying. It's starting. It hasn't burst and just collapsed totally, because that's when they will look for an alternative. We won't have the distraction of coronavirus. We're going to have a distraction of why everybody has to get behind the war effort. It's happened before. It could happen again.
It could happen again. Beware. You know, beware. So, but you had some headlines. You things were...
Yes,
to get
I
off
do
your
have
chest.
A little bit here. let's see. This one got my attention from a Yale professor, Yale epidemiologist. And he's writing about, has done work in hydroxychloroquine, which is a good one. I think, and he's been on Fox a couple times, and Fox is coming across, pretty objective on this now. They're starting to open up and at least entertain, you know, the possibility of coming more in our direction. And but he said that if they would allow the hydroxychloroquine to be used, it could save 100,000 lives. Well, that's not their goal.
Yeah.
We have to get those numbers up, you know. So the other thing is the experiments, I mean, he reports, of course, it's been around for 65 years. It's very cheap. It's really not dangerous. I was telling you earlier on, I think one thing that would happen, if there was a lot of danger with the use of that drug, what if they knew last year 25 people died from chloroquine? But how many stories have you heard about, you've heard stories, it's dangerous. And what happened? The FDA said, you can't use it unless you go through the hoops, because we're taking care of another drug company, and their drugs are so much better, and the prices are so much better. I mean, worse. You know, a shot will cost $4,000, $5,000. And chloroquine, they said it's, a couple dollars, $5 or $10. And he actually argues it should be, over the counter. Of course, a good libertarian would argue the case that we don't need the FDA, and you do it over the counter, and the control of this is done by private people monitoring and giving the approval of whether it's a good drug or not, not government, because this is incestuous. These drug companies and the FDA, I mean, this is just horrible. And that's all mixed up here. And when you get into also the pricing and the different companies, we've talked about it, but I'm just hearing more and more figures that are outlandish of how many drug companies are trying to get a vaccine and how lousy these contracts are that we're signing to the tune of billions of dollars, even if they don't work. The one they just signed up with, they say it was 50% effective. But if something comes along and 70% effective, we have still an obligation to keep buying the order that we put in. So it's a terrible deal. And of course, the FDA, really, I think they, people say, well, who's going to do it? Who's going to tell us which drugs to use and which ones not to use? Well, maybe somebody in the marketplace will do that. Maybe it'll be a private organization that will give us the information. Because when the FDA does it, you know, sometimes you feel like, well, the FDA approved this, so the doctor goes ahead and uses drugs. And I refuse to use some that FDA approved. It turned out they didn't work. But the irony of it all is, even when the FDA puts their approval on there, you can get sued for using the drug. It doesn't protect you at all. So I'm voting today to, if we want to deal with this and the dealing with chloroquine and all these, get rid of the FDA to begin with and let the marketplace make some of these decisions and let chloroquine be sold over the counter. And I think that a lot of people would much rather try that than rush off to the emergency room or rush to get a test where you sit in a car for 7 hours waiting to get a test, something, you know, and then the tests, you know, they're unreliable. So it's a mess. It's a much better way to handle this. This has been the worst endemic, pandemic, epidemic, what we've ever seen. And it's on, not that there's, not that it's more deadly than anything we've seen, but the reaction has been very deadly.
And it almost reminds you of the military industrial complex. You know, they have these guaranteed contracts. It's absolutely welfare for the rich. Literally, when you talk about someone like Scott Gottlieb, who used to head the FDA, and we talked about him yesterday over there on TV all the time talking about vaccines, and here we find out he's on the board of Pfizer, and he stands to make a bunch of money from Pfizer getting this multi-billion dollar contract, whether it's vaccines work or not. So it's absolutely corrupt, you're right, and it just shows how evil the whole system is. You know, the American people, 40 million of them lose their jobs, and the rich and well-connected are getting billions of dollars in the process. So it's a mess.
Well, here's another one. It came from River City's Reader, and they're quoting from a PhD, Dennis Rancourt, and he provides the evidence and his understanding, and his conclusions are masks do not work. And he goes over the review of the science, but I think a lot of people admit that, and yet at the same time, you know, nobody's going to change anything. You know, up until a week or so ago, Trump had the right opinion, you know, about it.
Yeah.
But once again, what that does, and they throw it at us, is, oh, if you don't go along with the somebody dying from coronavirus because they didn't have a mask on, that you're guilty. You're guilty of something. And that's hard to overcome. But quite frankly, I don't think the mask has saved anybody's life. I think we have talked about the individuals who are compromised already, that the mask is not a benefit. It is an impediment to getting good air, good breathing. So that it's too bad that more people don't come around to that. Let's say 2 years from now, everybody accepts, they come down and it's on all the television program. We're sorry to report to you, but we made a mistake, and we're sorry you had to spend the money and have a little bit of anxiety, but the masks were really ridiculous.
Yeah.
Can you, of course, they wouldn't do it. They're going to keep the story going, but I think that the pandemic that they helped to create probably would have been very small if we didn't have the lockdown and all the regulations. I think they'll make fun of social distancing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that to me is really silly. Or arresting people on the beach, people up in the mountains walking and strolling, wearing masks on. People are really, really frightened, you know, about it.
Yeah.
And so you can't blame them for doing things you think aren't logical. But the situation is that they're hearing the propaganda day in and day out.
Well, they get hammered with it constantly. And the propaganda is, if you're not wearing a mask, you want to kill people. And it's getting nastier. You go into a store without a mask on, and people do start acting very strange to you. But the other thing we wanted to bring up just quickly is the WHO, World Health Organization. This is something that came across our desk yesterday, and it's pretty interesting. They hire a PR firm. They're spending a lot of money, a lot of money. Guess who they hire? Hill & Knowlton. This is the company, as you remember, that faked the congressional testimony before the first Gulf War when they presented as a nurse talking about throwing the babies from the incubators, a young woman who actually happened to be the daughter of the ambassador to the U.S. Of Kuwait. So this is a firm that's pretty sketchy. And here's what they did. They proposed, part of their plan is they want to identify celebrities who are going to go on record saying how wonderful it is to follow the WHO guidelines, put on your masks, and all these things. And it makes you wonder, because we did see a lot of that earlier. We saw a lot of celebrities, people like Tom Hanks. I don't know if he was involved in this, but he got a lot of attention when he talked about, you know, follow the, you know, what you're supposed to do, follow the WHO. And so this is the kind of thing they're doing. I call it raw propaganda. Yeah, they shouldn't be using certainly our money, because we have funded it, and hopefully Trump sticks with not funding them. But this is a travesty to hire a company and pay them all this money to lie to us, to propagandize us. And I bet this is the tip of the iceberg.
Yes. No matter what they get involved in, there's very little authority in the Constitution to get involved in these medical things and social distancing and all this thing. But we're all capable of making mistakes, and we have to be careful about it. We have to have backups. We have to have monitors. But I find the government being the worst monitor possible, because they'll make mistakes too, and then everybody suffered. But what about the fraud? When it invites the fraud and all these contracts they make, the military-industrial complex, the crony capitalism, probably one of the worst consequences of this crony capitalism and this alliance between big business, the billionaires. You know, I've thought about this a lot. Why do the billionaires give money to the socialists?
Yeah,
and they do. And you know, you heard about the many wealthy industrialists that gave money to Hitler. And I think it's back to the thing that we have talked about. They give money not because they love what the Marxists and the socialists are saying, but they're not into that business. They're into the business of power and money. And therefore, they want to be an ally. And the Marxists, and currently, you know, they get money,
yeah,
you know, from Soros and other very wealthy. And the wealthy people rolled over on some of this stuff. I can't believe that they just love all this. The big the largest sporting events, they all rolled over too.
Yeah.
I just don't believe they believe that, but pay it down, you know, for their bottom line, they did, and they went along with it. But I think that it's an unusual coalition, but I think it's, you know, the super wealthy getting together because they think their power and wealth can be protected by letting these other individuals who are going to do the grassroots work. And I guess maybe internally each one thinks they're going to come out on top in total. But what really happens long term on all those things happens, like the Soviet system coming crashing down, the Nazi system come crashing down. That's the ultimate end of these coalitions. That's why, you know, it's one of the biggest challenges we have is letting people know there's a difference between crony capitalism and capitalism, because free markets, we're all lumped in, and that's how the socialists and the Marxists get their way. Look at what they're doing. Look, look at this FDA. Yeah. That's capitalism for you.
Yeah.
And of course, it isn't capitalism. It's corporatism, and and they work together, and they've done it for many, many years. And I guess it's a natural thing for people to do the grassroots work, and the other ones are producing the money and making money, and they don't have. I don't think the people that are involved in this have a deep concern for the individuals, the middle class, the poverty people, even though that's their excuse. You know, they're coming to do this so much good.
Yeah, the other thing they should study is the French Revolution. You know, the French nobility, by and large, was in favor of it, and then they ended up losing their heads over the whole thing. I'm going to go over a couple of quick headlines that I've noticed that are interesting, and I always like to show things that highlight how absurd things are. If we can go to that PDF, which is the last thing here, look at this, Dr. Paul. Police in Hawaii arrest a California man for violating the quarantine rule. The Kauai police arrested 43-year-old Michael Pechtal of Pacific Grove, California, for violating Hawaii's 14-day quarantine emergency rules pertaining to COVID-19. The quarantine requires that all trans-Pacific visitors and returning residents stay in an approved accommodation for 14 days, including having food delivered. So you go to Hawaii on a trip and you end up in jail is what happened. And this guy wanted to break out of jail and they arrested him, and now he's facing jail, actual jail. So, and you think, oh my gosh, Hawaii must have thousands of deaths. Well, look at the next one. Here's Hawaii. If you look at that next clip, almost zero. Let's go look at the next one to give it some context. 25 deaths in the whole state for coronavirus, and they're putting this guy in jail for not quarantining. I wonder how that's working out for their tourism business. I want to do a couple of quick things now just on the Houston and Texas situation, because it's key, I think, to what's happening in the country, and it's some good news, so I think we should relish it a little bit. Can we go to the next one? Here is COVID data through 7/21, clear downward trend in positivity rate. What you're seeing is that light blue line is tests. So tests are still increasing, but the positivity rate and the trend line, if you look at those, the blue columns are going down. So even as testing is going up in number, the positivity is going down. And that is certainly good news. You see the hospitalization is going down. Cases detected is going down. Those are the bottom two. One more. Now, this is Houston hospitals. You're seeing the 7-day average on cases down 4 days in a row. You're seeing the ICU census. It's the red line going way down. You're seeing the general census of hospitalization, the green line going way down, and you're seeing the cases detected going way down. So despite what everyone is saying, the disease, the virus, is running its natural course through the Sun Belt states. So
you okay?
That's it. I'm done, yeah.
Okay, very good. And I'm done too, but I hope our audience is satisfied that we got a little bit of information out there. But, you know, it still is the problem, is the information getting out. And, you know, on the desk, even when they report them, they're not really, we can't trust them because, you know, they just mark it down. They might not have even had a test. So even that is not reliable. So it's one of those things that is difficult. But a lot of people say, Ron, that sounds good. But you have to have a lot of people working, a lot of money to collect the data so that people can be warned on what to do and when to put their mask on. So you have to do it that way. What would happen? You can't do it with anarchy. If you don't have a government, you have anarchy. No, anarchy is what you see, on the streets that are brought about by the people who want to dispel with everything that is. You know, responsible right now. But they don't realize that if you give up on the government doing things, that doesn't mean it won't get done. Matter of fact, it shifts the burden from the politicians and the bureaucrats and the insiders and the crony capitalists over into individuals who will come together and work together and provide that. There's been information, you know, like Consumer Reports and other groups, they get together and give pretty good information. That is so much better than depending on the government. We have, people now are more than ever questioning what the government says, but then at the same time, people roll over because it doesn't take much to, you know, really build up fear in people. So it's the ability of the people to drive up the fear factor, and that is what's happened here just in 6 months. It's been tremendous, and they can cancel that out so quickly. Same way with a war effort. Right now, you know, people would say, well, we don't need to go to war, but I don't think it would take a whole lot for the American people to jump up and down and go along with the people that are advocating bombing China, which is ridiculous. But it's the job is finding the truth and then getting people credible enough that people will believe it. And the one thing that I have come to a conclusion of is that the government is not the group that's supposed to deliver the truth to us. Matter of fact, we should be watching them very carefully, and that would be a big help for us to be able to promote the cause for peace and prosperity. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.